So we're going to be talking about privacy, and I just want to be perfectly transparent, perfectly clear on my position. I am pro-privacy, and this is a pro-privacy shiur. So even though the title that I gave was to share or not to share, actually this is a shiur about not sharing. Or at the very least, it's a shiur about not forcing other people to share what they are not interested in, or, that they have not decided that they would like to share. And so this is really a shiur about respecting privacy, not about sort of down with privacy. And we're going to be talking somewhat about what the value is of privacy. But I just want to make the argument, and Michael and I were talking about this over lunch, sort of a right to privacy, that we're going to be talking about what the values are of privacy, but I don't want that to take away from what I think is more fundamental, which is that privacy does not need to be defended, right? If I were to give a shiur about pain, and I were to say, you know, we are trying to avoid people experiencing pain, and I might talk about, you know, how physical pain has, you know, psychological dimensions, and somehow, and if somebody's experiencing a lot of pain, it can have, you know, a negative effect on, you know, the people that surround them. But the question of, is pain good or is pain bad, or do people have, you know, the right to a pain-free existence, would not really be the topic of the shiur, because I don't need to explain to you that pain is bad, that pain is painful. Right, so as we talk about, you know, what are some of the values behind maintaining one's privacy or maintaining someone else's privacy, I want to preserve the integrity and sort of the right to say that privacy actually is fundamental, right? It's a fundamental good in and of its own, and doesn't need to be justified, even as we proceed to justify it. Okay, so with that very important caveat, what is the value of privacy? When you think about someone violating your privacy, what feels wrong about that? And what feels important, or what feels sacred, or what feels whole about maintaining privacy? Yes.
Did I get to choose?
Say more.
Did I get to choose what I want to share and what I don't want to share? For different people, the line might be in different places, but things that have to do with me, I get to choose.
Great, right? So there's something about agency, right? Being able to choose what I'm going to reveal and what I'm going to conceal puts me as the master of the knowledge of me, which is very important. Great, yeah.
So, right, we just had in the Haftorah that we're supposed to be tsniut with Hashem. So somehow...
I'll repeat.
So somehow modesty, which would incorporate privacy... And not always being out in front about yourself, is in fact something that we have a duty to do, even more than the agency if we would like it. God is sort of expects it from us.
Good. So Richard pointed to that there might even be a moral quality of modesty that's connected to privacy. And there's some kind of divine demand that we conduct ourselves in a way that's not showy, right? In a way that's more modest, in a way that's more private. Great. Any other ideas about what's valuable? Yes.
Also, in this week's or last week's Torah portion, you're the Matto Vua Olatha Avoda, your tents, the classic.
You are a prophet, just like Bilam, because we are going to see that source.
Then let it go. Okay, for now.
Perfect. Thank you. I'll let you read it. How's that?
That'll
make
teach
up.
Me, right?
Anyone else? Anything that, you know, feels important about privacy? Yes.
Just about the sense that in our what we do in private, it's also important to know that someone else is still watching. I mean, that just because we're alone doesn't mean we should break the rule.
Good. Right. I'll make an analogy to that. Right. One way of looking at the fact that a Jewish person cannot be owned by another Jewish person, one way to look at that is because Jews can't be slaves. But the way that the Torah speaks about it is that it imagines God saying, a Jew can't be a slave because every Jew belongs to me, right? Because every Jew is my slave, right? And so one way of thinking about the conversation about privacy is that each person is the master of their own domain. They get to choose what they conceal and what they reveal. And you're pointing to another aspect of privacy, that the private domain is actually the shared domain, but it's the shared domain between us and God. Right? And that there's something actually extremely, and I think here the term sacred is very appropriate. There's something sacred about the things that are private, not because they're not shared, but because they're shared with God. Great. Yes.
When one is public by use of their mouth or the technology, one is giving out, okay? When one is listening, you're taking in. You can't talk and listen at the same time. So receiving information, receiving things that are important, even being able to discriminate between what might not be as important as the next, you have to be actively listening, filtering, taking in.
Great. So what you're pointing to, again, I think on the moral quality spectrum, is that there's often a connection between people who are private and people who are quiet. Right? It's not that they're not revealing their secrets, that they're not showing themselves off. Right? And there's a certain element of a moral value of privacy or quiet that's connected to modesty. Right, and is connected to this sense that when I'm keeping things unrevealed, I'm also keeping them quiet, and in that sense, I'm more, let's say, receptive to other inputs that are going on in my life. Great. Was your hand up, Mike?
Yeah. I guess I was going to just say that it's like the value of privacy is that one can develop character, or another. Yeah, I get, like, I don't know if that would fall under the agency argument or, like, the moral kind of argument, but I think that I agree with the point that, like, if you're speaking or you're revealing something all the time, there's nothing to really, like, hide in terms of character. Like, I think of someone maybe like a Lenny Bruce or someone like that, like a comedian that part of their comedy, right, is, like, sharing everything about themselves on the stage.
Right.
And then, like, what's there, like, after the stage, you
right.
know? So I think it's like an ability to actually develop character and therefore to have like relationships.
Good. Beautiful. And we're going to also touch on a text that touches on that. Great. But first, we're going to move into the neighborhood. But the neighborhood is going to be the neighborhood in the times of the Mishnah and the early part of the Gemara. Because in order to really understand the Talmudic and Mishnaic perspective on privacy, the way that the Torah really talks about privacy, we're also going to talk about the sort of Lashon Hara lens that Rav Jason spoke about, but more fundamental to that, there's an idea called Hezek Re'iya. So the root of the word Re'iya is Ra'ah, right, to see, and the root of the word Hezek is actually Nezek, to damage, and it's damage done by seeing. Right, and the right to privacy is articulated in Jewish law as you are not allowed to damage me by violating my privacy, by watching me in my private space when I haven't given you express permission to do that. So in order to understand our first source where we talk about the damage of seeing, we have to construct the neighborhood. Those of us who live in the city, we're accustomed to a grid and high-rise buildings. Those of us who live in the suburbs, we're accustomed to sort of cul-de-sacs. Right? There are different ways that cities can be laid out. So let's imagine our Mishnaic town. Our Mishnaic town has a courtyard. Right? The chatzer. And the chatzer is shared by the sharers. Right, or the neighbors. Right? So I am not going, it's not that everybody has their own lawn, like they do in Bergen County, New Jersey. It's that a couple of people, right, will share the same lawn. So here's one house, and here's another house, and here's another house, and here's another house, and here's another house. And we're all neighbors, and we all have equal access to this courtyard. Right, and so when we talk about an Eruv on Shabbat, right, we're actually talking about these different people being joined by the fact that they are going to all participate in this in like a shared meal that could happen in this courtyard, and all of these people who are in their own private homes are going to be joined together in one big private neighborhood. That's just, it's a little architectural freebie. Okay. So usually, right, this courtyard is going to open out to an alley. And then this alley is going to open out to another alley, until you finally get to this thing, which everybody knows exactly what I'm drawing. This is like the best game of Pictionary I ever played. Yes, this is the public thoroughfare, right? And it's more like the Shuk, right? It's more like a public marketplace than it is just a public space. So you have your private space, you have your shared semi-private space, you have your these, you know, areas that are kind of public walkways, and then you have where everybody is. Okay. And these, in these like little houses, often people, when they build houses, want to build windows. Now, those of us who live in Manhattan are going to really enjoy what we are going to be talking about next. I have across the air shaft neighbors. And let me tell you, I know way more than I ever, ever would want to know about these people. In the summer, in the what they do in the winter, I have no idea. But I know exactly what goes on in the summer. I know their favorite TV shows in the summer. And they know mine because both of our windows are open to the air shaft. And I feel very blessed that I have large windows. But sometimes when I'm davening mincha, unfortunately, east is towards the air shaft. I'm this. And I look up and I make eye contact with my neighbor from across the air shaft. And he gives me like a... I sort of am acknowledging that I'm seeing you, but I can't really acknowledge that I'm seeing you. And why are you praying to me? Which are great questions, right, that are never explicitly asked. Right, but it's the kind of dynamic that we're talking about in this shared courtyard. Yeah, Richard, do you have a question?
Just a quick comment that for those of us who grew up in suburbia, the stories from our parents was always the big change that air conditioning made, because suddenly people had privacy in the summer.
Yes.
Whereas before that, they knew everything about their neighbors.
Because instead of having the windows be open, the windows are closed and there's some sort of loud buzzing box. Great. Okay. We finally made it to the yellow section of the Yomiyun packets, but we are in the second half of the yellow section, page one. Okay. So we are in Shulchan Aruch, right? This is the first, in some sense, the most central code of Jewish law that we have. And here we go. We're talking about building our houses, these guys. Okay. Lo yiftach adam chalon l'chatzer chaveiro. A person should not open up a window to the chatzer of his friend. Because right next to this chatzer is another chatzer, right? It's another courtyard. And if I want to open my window, I can't open my window in a way that it could see on, it could be seen, it could look on, it could look down on this courtyard. Because my neighbor is doing his yoga, he's hanging his laundry, right? And there's some expectation that he's in a kind of private area. I'm not allowed to open up, construct a window that faces into his chatzer. And even if one of the neighbors in the yard wanted to open up a window in his own house onto the yard, his neighbor can prevent him because he can see him through it. Right, so anybody who is in here and doesn't want to be seen by this guy, or this guy, even though it's his house, and they actually have no financial connection to one another, he's not allowed to build his house in a way where this guy would say, I don't like that you can see me. Right, so it impinges on my ability to construct my house the way that I want to if it looks down onto this person's yard. Okay. And if he opened it, what if I already built my house? Right? Don't ask permission, ask for forgiveness. And if he opened it, he should close it. Okay. And these shoulds are really musts. Okay. And if he is facing a different yard, where they have given him permission to install a window or a doorway, he has to distance it from the facing doorway or the window of his friend until he can't see him through it at all. Right? So if he's in a situation where all these people say, it's no problem, we're going to be hanging out in here, but we are wearing, you know, baggy yoga pants, so we don't care if you see us doing our yoga. This person who's constructing, it's probably better to be this person, right? This person who's allowed to construct his window so that he can see into here has to be careful not to construct his window in a way where he can see into here, right? So even though he's got the building permit from the folks in the office to say, you're allowed to, the people in your immediate chatzer say it's fine, you still have to be sure all of the chatzers, anybody who could possibly be seen, you need to construct your window in a way that you are not impinging on any of these people's privacy. Okay, but a person may install a house doorway onto the public domain facing another house doorway, or a window facing a window, even if they are not taller than 4 amot. So let's say the Bobs live here. That's not useful for you. And the Marks live here. Here's the public thoroughfare. Anybody and everybody walks through here. So we can open our doors to face the public thoroughfare, even though I've now created a direct line of sight between the Bobs and the Marks. And why can't Mark say to Bob, you have to make your door here?
Because you live by the public thoroughfare, you've sacrificed all claims to privacy.
Good, right? He can say to him, I am like one of the people in the public domain who see you. Right? You're already doing all of, you already have no privacy because you've built your house with a doorway facing the public thoroughfare. Right? So therefore, Mark has sacrificed his right to privacy from Bob. But if Mark had been careful to open the door and his property this way, right? And somehow maybe like Mark has a window that's above 4 amot. I don't have enough dimension to like actually get it higher. Oh dear, I'm not gifted in this way. Let's say he has a window up here. Okay. Bob has to be careful for Mark's window, if it's above 4 amot, because 4 amot is basically 6 feet, and that's considered to be maximum height. That's not really the case anymore, but back in the day, people weren't so well nourished. I don't know what happened to me, I was very well nourished. Right, but the assumption is that the sight line is not above 4 amot. So whatever I'm sacrificing in terms of construction to be seen by the people in the public thoroughfare, that only counts for things that I've constructed under 4 amot. If I'm wealthy and I have a second story to my house and there's a window up there, and Bob wants to create his own window, and now I've created a sight line. Oops. Now I've created a sight line from Bob's upper window to Mark's upper window, right? Then the whole thing gets reset. Because the people in the public thoroughfare are only, they only violate the privacy up to 4 amot. Once we're on the second floor of the house, then it's just Bob and Mark trying to figure out how they can live in privacy and harmony. Okay. There are those who say, we are 3 lines from the bottom in source number 1. There are those who say that a person has to be careful not to look in his friend's house. Right? And I think this is sort of the case even when there is permission, right? You're either on the public thoroughfare, you're walking by, and you see that your friend's door is open. You're not supposed to lean in, right? Even though ostensibly he sacrificed his right to privacy, you're not supposed to just sort of like, what's going on in the Mark's house? Lest he be seen as a thief in this seeing, since he has no reason to do it. Hivan she'ein lo ta'ana, because he has no claim. Okay? Right, so this conclusion of the Shulchan, it's not the conclusion of all these laws, but the conclusion of this source, right, of the Shulchan Aruch, right, imagines that even in a case where we're talking about my my house that opens onto the public sphere, or we'll see it in another source, even my field, right, there's actually this sense that other people are not supposed to be looking at it, even if it isn't 100%, you know, by the book, private area. And this last phrase of kevan she'ein lo ta'ana, because he doesn't have a claim, right, I think is, if this is all you get from this entire session, right, this is the most important thing, right? If I want to look at you, I need to have a claim. I need to have permission to look at you. You don't have to cover yourself up, right? There's no halachot of blinds, right? There's no saying, well, Mark and Bob are going to have this conversation, and Bob can say to Mark, you don't want me to see you? Get some shades, right? That's not what happens. It's on Mark. Oh, he screwed it up. Whatever. It's on the other person, right, to make sure that he does not look at someone else. It is not the person who is being seen's responsibility to make sure that other people are looking at them. This is very helpful in terms of rape culture. This kind of way of viewing the world, right, is extremely fundamental to the Jewish laws of privacy. You have to explain to me what you're doing looking at my house. I don't need to justify anything to you. I have the right to privacy. Unless you have a reason to look at me, you should be averting your eyes. Okay, yes, Michael.
It says, yes, Yeshonim. Does that somehow mitigate the universality of this principle? Or?
So it's a yesh omrim in terms of, it's kind of a moral extra, lishni mishurat hadin, sort of beyond the letter of the law, saying, right, that you should not be doing it. Because the person who has, you know, either between their neighbors permitted sight, or between the public sphere and their own door permitted sight lines, right, they don't have a legal claim to say to someone, you know, don't look. But there are some people who say that even in that situation, right, this person needs to be careful not to avail themselves, right, of the scene of their friend's life. It's not the Shulchan Aruch's own idea, so that's where the Yesh Omrim comes from, and it's not a legal principle. I can't bring you to court if I live on Broadway and I see you looking into my window.
And what would constitute a ta'ana?
What would constitute a ta'ana? Well, I think there's, like, one way to read it is an invitation, right? There's no, he can't say back to him, well, you told me to come over because I'm supposed to pick up your lawnmower. How am I supposed to come and pick up your lawnmower if you don't let me into your house, you don't let me see things around? And there are also some rare cases, right, where people are permitted to sort of take the law into their own hands. And you can imagine, right, someone saying, well, you know, you took my lawnmower last week, you never gave it back, and I've been waiting for it, so I'm just going to take a little peek-saloo into your house to see if I can, well, lawnmower's not going to be in the house, to see if I can, in your shed, right, to see if I can find the lawnmower, and that's a sufficient claim, right, for me to be looking in your public area.
Yeah. Right, because the phrase nidpas kaganav is also really important here, related to it. So at what point does my peeking in become breaking and entering?
Great, right. I think there's sort of both, but there's one sense that actually, right, there is a theft in the watching, that you appear to be a thief because you're, you know, getting this entertainment through somebody else's life. And I think there's also that second element of, you look like you're casing the joint, right? Why are you snooping around my property? The only reason why you would be doing that is either to violate my privacy, which you're not allowed to do, or to figure out how to steal my stuff, right? You can't say, well, I was curious. That's not justification, right? Your better excuse is to say, I was going to steal from you, but I decided not to. Yeah.
Of course, Facebook and Google throw everything upside down.
Great, right. So the way that, like, it's helpful to have this connect to the internet, right, is that we're all neighbors now, right? People in Kuala Lumpur are our neighbors because it only takes me, you know, 30 seconds to communicate with them, right? And we need to sort of figure out in this global internet neighborhood, right, what does it mean for me to be respectful of someone else's privacy, right, even if they have put something up that may not be sort of totally private. And I think that a good example of the way that, like, we could be sensitive to this. often people have email addresses that are similar to other people's email. Right? And somebody sends you, it's supposed to go to Dina Weiss with two S's, and instead it goes to Dina Weiss with one S. And Dina Weiss with one S is sitting there with an email that's supposed to go to me. Right? She can still respect this idea of privacy by saying, I'm not going to read this email. I'm just going to let the person who sent it know, right, that it went to the wrong Dina Weiss. And so even when something is revealed to you, right, there still are those moments where you can ask yourself that question, do I want to peek into something that isn't really designed for me, even though it's available for me to look at?
I mean, Facebook's one thing because people choose to be on there, and sort of like if you're saying I'm not, my life is no longer private, I'm opening it up to the world. But if Google presents another old thing, because all of a sudden you can Google a person and sort of find out things about them that maybe they don't even know. I mean, I'm saying since we're doing technology, all this thing starts to tap into privacy and individual, which put out there.
Great, and we're going to talk about sort of how to think about that knowledge when we get to some later sources. Yes.
Seems to be a very one-sided problem here. Is there any limitations in what you can do in front of your open window? Can you stand there naked with the intent of attracting attention?
Can you stand there naked with the intent of attracting attention?
Or do something peculiar
attention?
With the intent of attracting attention and then complain, hey, this guy's looking at me. You know?
Well, so... so great.
You don't have to put up shades. I mean, what's the limitations?
Right, so the goal is, right, that the way that the buildings are going to be constructed is that anybody who's doing their sort of normal routine without trying to see you is not going to see you. So even if I were to be doing, you know, jumping jacks with a jester hat, you know, to some sort of crazy Madonna routine, which anybody would love to see, right, where I'm going to be doing it is presumably going to be, my window is not going to be facing anybody else. So if somebody saw it, it would mean that they were somehow like trying to get in there. And in terms of the case of the person that has their door to the public sphere, yeah, I would say like that person doesn't have the right to say, I can't believe you were staring at me when they're doing something that's clearly trying to draw attention to themselves. But also, that's because they've already revoked their right for that window or that door to be private to them. Yeah, Richard.
So Facebook, you could sort of say, is like the public thoroughfare. You know that you're putting yourself out there and you're likely to be seen. The case that, two cases that strike me more relevant are when Sony was hacked.
Uh-huh.
And so all their private stuff was out of the public domain. Should we have been looking at that? Should we have benefited from
right.
it and gossiped about it and made economic decisions about it? That seems like hazardia. And then there's an odd case with the federal government where I work. When Snowden released all of his stuff, we're not allowed to read it because the federal government is telling us it's still classified, it's still private, even though by definition it's not private, but we can't look at it because it's still private. So
great.
The government takes that position.
Great, beautiful. Yeah, Monty, do you have your hand up? Okay. Let's move on. We're going to see the source for this. It's an agotic source, which Mark already... It's your turn to shine. Okay. Well, I take away my promise that you're going to get to read this source. Who wants to read source number 2 on page number 1, Bhava Batra 60? Thank you.
From where do we know this, Rabbi Yochanan said? As the verse says, Bil'am lifted his eyes and saw Israel residing according to their tribes. What did he see? He saw that the openings of their tents were not aligned with one another. He said, these are worthy of the presence of the divine.
Good. Right, and so all of you who are trying to make moral arguments about privacy, right, this seems to be, right, part of what's going on with this text from Bil'am. Bil'am is blessing the Jews because he sees that they conduct themselves in a way that's modest. Right, he sees that they're strategic about it. Right, it's not that they happen when they walk by to avert their eyes, but the way that they built their town, the way that they built their encampment, right, is in a way where everybody feels protected and everybody feels private. Yes.
But there's clear intentionality here. We're gonna construct an architecture that clearly signals that privacy is important. If people do not do that, If they do not express that intentionality, they don't put the right privacy settings on Facebook or whatever, what applies, right?
And I think there's something like very valuable here in that the halachot are neighbor to neighbor, right? But the source text is on the national level. What is the society that we want to construct? We want to construct a society of modesty, right? Of respect and of privacy. And it happens to be that the way that we do that, right, is with this hand-to-hand combat on the construction permits and how can you build your house and my impinging on your right to build your house the way that you want to because my right to privacy is stronger. Okay, great. And the Ramban, commenting here, says that there are three reasons for the prohibition of hezek ri'ya, of damage through sight. And even more so regarding damage inflicted by sight, hezek ri'ya, because these are interpersonal damages. Irrespective of if they are because of the evil eye, ayin hara, evil speech, lashon hara, or because of modesty, tzniut, right? So the Ramban, as he's talking about how important hezek ri'ya is, as a sort of parenthetical, he says, it's important and it's significant. Nobody disagrees that it is considered to be real damage, regardless of how you look at it. And you can look at it through one of these three lenses, about the evil eye, about evil speech, or about privacy. Sorry, about modesty. And further, who knows what could happen to make him relinquish his rights? Also, even if the damaged did relinquish his rights, since it is definitely forbidden to the damager to damage him by seeing and to knowingly look at him, and no person can be sufficiently careful about this, right, to stand all day with closed eyes, so we are compelled to say to him, close your window and you will not sin constantly. Right? So the Ramban is saying, he's not even really entertaining, right, the world where I say to you, shut your blinds. That's not the world that he's entertaining, but he's saying, it's possible you might have imagined the world where we just say to someone, you're not allowed to look at that person, so don't look. And the Ramban is saying, it's theoretically possible to say to someone, don't look, but it's not actually possible. So instead of telling him some sort of moral code that you're not supposed to look at other people, we say this is how you have to build your house, so that you're not going to be in a situation where you actually have access to seeing other people's private lives. Right? And there's something so powerful, right, about this. Right? The Ramban is saying, without this, we're all going to be in everybody else's business. Right? Even if I think that it's wrong, and even if I want to walk through the world with my eyes closed, the prurient desire to know what's going on in my neighbor's house is going to be too strong. And the only way for me to avoid it is for me to actually be physically unable to see into his home. Yeah,
quick grammar question. So yes. This last sentence, close your window. Whose window?
The window of the person who is building and wants to build it onto the public, onto the chatzer that's shared, or to the house of somebody else.
The seer.
Okay. I like to be thorough. So we're going to just briefly talk about the Ayin Hara. It's not really going to be the focus of our conversation, but the Ramban said that might be one of the reasons why we're not allowed to look at things, so just to dot those I's. Talmud Bavli Brachot. When Rav Dimi came, he said, not too tall or too short, not a minor or a deaf mute, not too ruddy or not too white, not too smart and not too dumb. What does this mean? Rav Dimi is saying, I just want to be I don't want to be too smart. I don't want to be too dumb. I don't want to be too fair-skinned. I don't want to be too ready. I just want to blend in. I want to be Waldo. Right? The Lo Chacham, and Rashi comments, why doesn't he want to be smart? Yoter midai, he doesn't want to be too smart. Or he doesn't want to be noticeably smart. So that he won't be a wonder in the eyes of people. And because they speak about him, the evil eye will have control over him. Right? Why does he want to be inconspicuous? Because if he is noticeable, then people are going to say, oh my gosh, Bobby is so smart. Did you hear what he said in DSHIR? That was amazing. And then the evil eye is going to somehow visit him. Right? There's some kind of superstition here. Right? That if you call attention to positive qualities, the evil eye is going to get you. And it becomes even like closer to our scenario in source number 3b. Rabbi Abau said, Rabbi Huna said, that Rav said, a person is forbidden from standing on his neighbor's field when the grain is fully grown. Or you have this a beautiful field, corn as far as the eye can see, and I am not allowed to stand at the edge of your field and just look at it, or to just appreciate how beautiful your crops are. Why? So that he not destroy it with the evil eye. Right? The more attention I place on the good things that are happening in your life, the more it attracts the evil eye, and the more likely it is that things are going to go in the opposite direction. Right? So why can't I look at you while you're living your private life? Because you have a good life. Right? And the more I pay attention to you, the more the evil eye is going to pay attention to you. And there's a kind of like a superstitious channeling of bad luck that happens when I can see what's going on in your life. So that's option number one. I would say not quite as 2015 as maybe some of the other options. I saw a hand over here. Yes?
Yeah, Adina, question for points of clarification.
Mm-hmm.
Let me replace some of the things that I see there, and then let me ask you the questions. I see where you have a courtyard which has an agreement or convention, as it were, that you one will relinquish a certain amount of privacy, but only with the people with whom one shares this courtyard. And then I see a public thoroughfare where if you have property on that, you have relinquished an even greater amount of privacy.
If you open a door or a window that faces the public side.
Okay. Height will mitigate certain circumstances.
Right.
But my assumption, not in that picture, is where you have somebody who has a totally private, not in the courtyard, or perhaps the king's palace.
Mm-hmm.
So
sorry.
What I'm asking is, there seems to be degrees of privacy that are inherent in here. And I'm wondering, is there, by implication, a certain class and economic structure that is given this? So when we think of it by extension to, let's say, using public roads, literally, or using the technological highway on the
mm-hmm.
internet and various fees, that people with greater money will have greater access, or the converse, greater privacy, and people of lower socioeconomic would, whether by choice, but by just their status and circumstances, have less.
Right. So these texts don't explicitly address that question.
Okay.
Right? But I think that you're totally correct. But we're talking about, a very densely populated area and the kind of people that need to live in densely populated areas. One way to sort of see these laws is to say, well, let's try to construct these densely populated areas in a way where people still have some modicum of privacy. Right.
It didn't work this way, by the way. Is this theoretical, or how practical was this when we're thinking of Jerusalem or whatever?
That's always the money question. I don't know.
Okay.
Definitely these laws, were kept on the books, and people were supposed to follow them.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the more real estate becomes dense, right, the harder it actually is to both say, you can have a window, and your window can't face anybody else. Right, so you do need to have enough of a rural structure with these yards, wherever, where you could actually say that. Because if the person who constructed my apartment building tried to make windows that didn't face anybody else, there would be no windows. There would be no windows.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I think you can extrapolate this idea to other contact and privacy, but we should also be sensitive, just foster this like sensitivity in what we assume might be providing someone with privacy or not. Like I know in Bava Batra, like later on it talks about like building a wall in that shared chatzer, and you might think you're like being really nice and building it really tall, but then you're actually obstructing that person's view. And so I think you can extrapolate to the other things, just be sensitive in what you think you're providing someone with privacy, but really you're doing them a disservice, just sort of, you know.
Good, right, and I think that you're pointing to, there's actually a lot of dialogue, right, that's happening both in the actual Gemaras and Bava Batra, and even once the halacha becomes a little bit more established, right, it's in the Shulchan Aruch, you're actually imagining neighbors talking to one another, where one neighbor can say to the other neighbor, you revoked this privacy, you lost this privacy right when you, you know, built your house in a certain way, and another neighbor being able to say to someone else, you have to close your window because I don't like what's, you know, that it's going on my yard. And once we're talking about, right, these kind of shared establishments, right, people can, of course, enter into an agreement where they say, actually, you know, the ability for me to have a clear sight line, right, from my window through your house to see, like, a beautiful mountain on the other side, and I'm willing, you know, to sacrifice to maybe, you know, change in a different area of my house so that I won't be exposed, right? Yes, you could imagine people having those kinds of arrangements. Yeah, good. Okay, we're done with the evil eye. And just in terms of modesty, I don't actually feel the need. I feel like that's kind of obvious, right, what's going on with modesty. Certainly in the case with Bilam, where we're imagining that the houses are not facing one another, right, the assumption is that what we're really talking about is that they're family units, right, if people can't see other people being intimate with their spouses, right, it's constructed in a way where the window or the door always faces a wall as opposed to facing another window. Now let's talk about evil speech. Favorite topic. I don't know what it is. I love talking about evil speech. Okay. This first text of Rabbi Aaron Yehuda Grossman, it's actually a very recent text, and the frame that Rav Jason used this morning about Lishna Tlita, this kind of, that Lashon Hara actually is about third-partiness, is really helpful in understanding this source. Who would like to read it? Thank you, Rachel.
In my humble opinion, in order to explain that which he wrote, that Hezek Ruiya is Lashon Hara, evil speech, the prohibition of Lashon Hara is when Reuven tells something to Shimon about Ruiya.
Good. Well, let's just pause here. Right? Whenever you want to have A, B, and C, but you're talking in the Talmud, you'll often just rely on the names of the tribes, or you rely on the names of the matriarchs if you need to talk about women. Right, so we have Reuven. I'm going to do it in English so that it's more. We have Reuven, Shimon, and Levi. Right, these are A, B, and C. Good. Right, the prohibition is that Reuven is the speaker. Shimon is the hearer. And Levi is the subject. These are three-party conversation. Good. Rachie, continue.
Just as Levi doesn't want Shimon to know about him, he also doesn't want Reuven to know. And therefore, when Reuven looks at the property of Shimon, he violates the prohibition of Lashon Hara.
Good. I want to pause you here because this is the most interesting part. Right. We're accustomed to thinking that what Lashon Hara is that Levi doesn't want Shimon, right, to know anything about him. So when Reuven goes and tells Shimon something about Levi, right, Levi's upset because Shimon wasn't supposed to hear it. But what we're learning here is that, well, there's another component of what's going on. It's not only that Levi doesn't want Shimon to hear the Lashon Hara. Reuven is not supposed to know the Lashon Hara. Right, it's not like Levi has his Facebook settings and there's a, you know, he has Shimon unlimited profile and Reuven has full access to his life. It's that there's something private about Levi, and just like he doesn't want Shimon to know about it, he also doesn't want Reuven to know about it. So when Reuven goes and acquires this knowledge about Levi, that's the first step of Lashon Hara. Because Lashon Hara, from the perspective of the subject, is I don't want anybody to know. I don't want B to know, and I don't want A to know. Continue, Richie.
And to bring a further source for the words of the Ramban from an explicit Yerushalmi in Kaya.
So whenever you have something that says it's explicit, you know it's going to take a little work to understand.
They asked Rabbi Yochanan, what is Lashon Hara? The one who says it and the one who knows it. And in my humble opinion, the Ramban learned, and the one who knows it, in its plain sense, that Reuben has done an action in knowing Shimon's business, and this is the prohibition of Lashon Hara. And even though the Chafetz Chaim didn't record this in his book, it is an explicit Ramban.
Good, right? Anybody writing in the 21st century about Lashon Hara, and they're trying to say something that the Chafetz Chaim didn't say, they need to say, the Chafetz Chaim, the king of Lashon Hara, right, didn't say this, but trust me, it's from an earlier source, it's in the Ramban, right? And this Yerushalmi and Pead that he's quoting, right, is this famous idea that Lashon Hara hurts three people, right? The one who speaks it, the one who hears it, and the one that it's about. But when Rabbi Yochanan talks about the one who speaks it, he actually refers to him as the one who knows it. So sort of Aaron Grossman says, yeah, right, that's the problem. The problem starts with Reuben. And why are we blaming Reuben? Reuben is actually supposed to deny himself that knowledge. Right? If he sees that Levi's about to do something juicy, he's not only prohibited from reporting it, he's prohibited from knowing it. Right? And that is the hezek ri'ah. That is the damage that's done by seeing. Because it's not that I don't want people talking about me. It's that I don't want people knowing about me. And I have that right. Okay. Any questions or comments about this source?
Well, it sounds like from the English translation that the knowing is from looking. It's not that Reuven was like a passive recipient of the information, that he heard it or he got the knowledge that way, but that he, that looking, just...
Right. Well, because...
Something about...
Right.
Well, it's like active and not active.
Right. I think there's a part of this where they're sort of bound by the language of damage through looking. They're more thinking about privacy in terms of sight than they're thinking about privacy in terms of hearing. And I think that also Rabbi Grossman, in his desire to like make his interesting point, right, he wants to say, we're so accustomed to thinking about Lashon Hara in terms of speaking and hearing, as opposed to thinking about what it actually is about, which is knowledge. And knowledge is associated with sight, perhaps even more so, right, than it's associated with hearing. But yes, right, it's not limited to that.
But another way of looking at it is if you go back to those three from the Ramban and Bava Batra, right? Like Lashon Hara, Ayin Hara, and Smiut. It's basically like it's all encompassing, right? It's what you say, it's what you see, it's like you're.
Right. It's very nice. Yes, for sure.
But usually you think of Lashon Hara as the actual giving over the information, and you're saying here Lashon Hara is just knowing the information.
Isn't that amazing?
Well, knowing it by seeking it out actively.
Right. It's not, right. If you happen to know something and you couldn't avoid hearing it, you haven't violated Lashon Hara. But if you have gone and you've taken a mental snapshot of someone doing something private, then they have not given you explicit permission to see.
Even if
you have violated Lashon Hara through hezek ri'ah, through the damage done by sight, just by knowing. Because when you look at things, right, from Levi's perspective, Levi doesn't care about whether it's Reuven or Shimon. Levi just wants it to be just Levi, or just Levi and God.
Yom Kippur just got harder.
Everything. Today is about everything getting harder.
You know, it's, I mean, maybe this relates, maybe it doesn't. I mean, you use the word snapshot, which is really interesting. Because part of what's going on in the backdrop is a snapshot of anybody is only a tiny, 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 tiny piece of who that person is. And so somehow by learning these little bits and pieces of knowing people, you're sort of denying them their completeness of who they are. And that it distorts our sense of who they are, and that's part of the problem of privacy. And it gets exacerbated, of course, in the modern world, you know, knowing little bits and pieces and thinking that's who the person is. They get frozen in that moment. And
that's very nice. That's very helpful. Right, and I think it also explains or dovetails with the phenomenon that the more somebody knows about me, the more I want them to know about me because I want them to have a more complete picture. And the less somebody knows about me, the more I feel shielded and the more I feel guarded because they're not in the running, right, to actually understand me and to be able to see what I'm doing in context. So I don't want to give them, right, random factoids that they are going to have to make up their own backstory for. Great, that's very helpful. Yes?
If I see somebody in the public square stealing a piece of fruit off a cart, I saw something that's illegal, that's not lashon hara.
Well, if I'm doing it in public.
If it's in public.
Good. Right, so he's trying to explain why when I look at somebody in private, why that's considered to be damaging as lashon hara. He's not claiming that every time I see anything, that's lashon hara. Right, he's just trying to figure out why those two are connected. He isn't saying that you have to walk around the world with your eyes closed and things that are in public you're also not allowed to see. So he's not quite going that far. I appreciate that, yes. Yeah.
I'm just noticing in the Ramban, it is kind of explicit, because the Ramban says, "Ulistakel bo
ladat." Mm-hmm. To look at him in order to see.
Yeah. So, maybe.
Great. That's very cute. Yeah.
And picking up on Matthew said in terms of snapshot, we don't have the content, and not having it, whether it is information that we have seen or heard or however we've gotten it, will lead us to making the wrong conclusions. And it's the wrong conclusions are usually the most harmful part. Mm-hmm. In my understanding, of lashon hara, because if somebody is doing something, okay, yeah, they should have privacy, but if somebody is truly doing something bad, and we understand it to be bad, but if somebody isn't, and we draw a conclusion that they have been doing something, then the implications and repercussions are even greater.
Yeah, I mean, I think that your comment sort of pushes us back to the major controversy between, you know, advocates for privacy and people that are, whatever, right? That if you don't have anything to hide, what are you so worried about, right? And what these sources are saying is that you don't have to justify, right, wanting something to be private. That is your right. You're not trying to hide something. You're just trying to be yourself without everybody else knowing about it, right? And that's considered to be acceptable, even without the overlay of concern that someone is going to distort it and say something bad about me, right? That there's actually a more fundamental component that they are getting illicit knowledge, and that I have the right to say that knowledge wasn't yours to take. And I just want to bring us back to this image of the three-party conversation, right, which lashon hara is, because the more you think about it as three-party and you say you're not allowed to have any three-party conversations, that's lashon hara. Right, what you're then saying is, here is how you're going to get information about people. You're going to walk up to them and say, you know, I'm really curious about something. I'd love to ask you about it. Right, and the only way that you can get information about someone is by walking up to them, asking them, and saying, what are you willing to share? Here is what I'm interested in. Right, that is totally the opposite, right, of our experience in this world. You know, when, like Mary was talking about, when she's going to hire someone, right? Often before the interview, before the resume, we've already Googled the person, right? We're already hearing about the person's reputation before we even know their name, right? There's some kind of reversal of the idea of what you want to share with me, right, is what I get to know. And we've moved past, you know, triple conversation to billion person conversations, right? That's how strong, that's how potent the level of knowledge and therefore the level of potential lashon hara, right, is in our society. That I can know so much about you and think that I know so much about your character and who you are without ever meeting you. Yeah.
Because we've now learned to some degree that there is a danger to all this assertion of privacy, which is that people then do bad things and hide behind it. And we've seen this certainly institutionally with places that have, you know, allowed bad things to happen for a long time, and only when privacy was violated do we find out it. And so how you balance this love of privacy that we should have that has a godly aspect to it, to this fear of if we don't know that the person was a criminal who we're about to hire, where do we go with that?
Right.
It's very hard. Is part of the challenge is just the love of lashon hara, but part of the challenge is this sort of knowledge that privacy isn't always a good thing.
Right. So that's really helpful. Part of the way that I think about this, right, is I like to make an internal distinction between, am I hiding something because it's private? Or am I hiding something because it's shameful? Right? And if the reason why I'm demanding privacy is because I've done something wrong and I don't want to get caught, I don't think that's covered by this. But that's not really what we're talking about. We're talking about people's right to live neutrally private lives, not to cover over, you know, the bad that they've done so that they don't get caught. But that we can say to someone, there's a right, there's a value of privacy even when it's not hiding, and you can assert it and you can want it even when you're not trying to hide that you've done something wrong. Yeah, Herb.
Can I just ask for further clarification on what we mean by the word private? I'm assuming any act done with any other human being without their consent is by definition not a private act. Because there are two people involved. So I'm having a lot of trouble trying to understand what we really mean by private.
So I don't think that private means solitary, right? I think private means without explicitly revealing, right? So if I go somewhere where I know that I'm going to be seen and I can't control who sees me, right, then that's public. Then there's the sort of medium courtyard setting where because I'm in a financial or familial relationship with you, I understand, right, that you are going to see me doing things that other people may not be able to see me do. And then there's the totally personal privacy of the things that only I and God can see. But I don't think that the middle category is exempt from the conversation of privacy. Yeah, John.
I had an experience a few years ago where I was sort of shocked that this was the meaning of Lashon Hara. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to tell somebody, it was a person here who I was learning with, who's a very, very genuinely, deeply pious and really sincere person. And I wanted to say to her something about a fellow student that was, and my motivation was absolutely not what we would call gossip in English. It was to better understand that person and their experience. And in my eyes, it made it, there's something in that person's experience that was very, very important and many people knew about. And I just thought it would help her to deal with him and understand all the more what an amazing human being he was. These were two wonderful people. And she just cut me off in the nicest possible way. And she said, I said, let me tell you something about Ruben. It wasn't his name, but let me tell you something about Ruben. And she just said, you know, if he wants me to know it, he'll just tell me.
Right.
She just wouldn't take it. And I kind of like, oh my God, I did something wrong. But in my guts, I didn't really feel like I was doing something wrong because my intention was to help her to understand him, the Sheva.
Right.
But not good enough.
Right. Well,
she was right, huh?
Right. I mean, I want to say two things. The first is that shutting people down by throwing the Lashon Hara card at them is never good for interpersonal relationships.
She just said, if he wants me to know, he'll tell me.
Right.
It took me a little while to go, the light went off in my head, but
right.
Didn't say that.
So I wouldn't say that you did something wrong, but I would also sort of suggest, right, that if you are tempted to create a three-party, you can create a two-party by saying to her, you know, I think you should ask Levy about, you know, his prayer practice. So you're not actually telling her anything about Levy, but you are cluing her in that that might be a really productive for her and conversation for her and Levy to have absent you, right? So you're taking out the third partiness. You're just sort of inviting that connection that you want. So that's sort of what I said, my suggestion, which is, take it or leave it, is to say, we don't want to have three-party communication where the way that you find out about Levy is through me, but you should know, right, that Levy has something interesting, and I bet if you asked him, he would really want to share it with you. And also that gives Levy the people who are private and special, and often those two things go together, right, aren't going to volunteer this thing about themselves. Right, so you have to figure out, if you really want this to be known, you need to make sure that Levy's on board, and you want it to be expressed in a way that Levy would feel most comfortable. Like, the easiest way to do that is to just say, hey, I think you should really talk to Levy. So that's my off the hook suggestions. Yeah.
So what about conversations about a third party in the interest of the benefit of the community? So, for instance, fundraising. You know, two people sit around and say, geez, should we, you know, we're fundraising for our shul. Now, should we ask that person for $1,800 or $50,000? So, yeah. Oh, let's talk about it. Where do the kids go to college? What kind of car are they driving? You know, these questions.
Prospect.
Right.
What would, you know, how would you respond to that?
That's a great question.
All fundraising. Excellent question.
Next! Right. And then also next to Richard's question about the need for knowledge for the sake of some kind of safety. And you're saying, well, often knowledge can lead us to do, like, really important things, even, you know, knowledge that has kind of a gossipy tinge. I think that what's actually kind of valuable is that what seems to be at issue in the whole Hezek Re'iyah thing is not specifically that you're not allowed to see things that are gossipy, but that you're not allowed to see things, right? So you're not allowed to watch this person sweep their front step, right, or do the dishes. Well, there's nothing, you don't talk about the way people sweep or the way that people do the dishes. But still, right, that's a private domestic thing, and unless they give you permission to see it, you're not allowed to see it. And so one of the things that this sort of helps us do is keep us from thinking about Lashon Hara in terms of the kind of things that we would want to gossip about. And then I think that also gives you permission on the other end, right, that just because something is the kind of thing that people gossip about it doesn't make it an invalid topic of conversation if it is for somehow, like, the public good. And what a kind of car a person drives, not private information. Where somebody's kids go to school is not private information. So if you are concerned about talking about it because it's gossipy, you can actually say to yourself, no, right, gossipy topics are not the problem. It's public-private that's the problem. And if this person is not trying to hide that they drive a Jaguar, there's really nothing wrong with you letting somebody else know, right, that that person drives a Jaguar. If you were trying to do another kind of Lashon Hara through this, I'd be like, can't believe, right, that person asked for a discount in their shul dues when I saw them driving a Jaguar, right, I think that would be, you know, a sort of different conversation.
But, you know,
not that I'm the world expert on Lashon Hara, but since I'm standing up here, I'll say whatever I think.
Two points. One is, typically when you talk about privacy, there's this notion that the private information is controlled by the person whose information is. They have a right to control who sees it.
Mm-hmm.
On the question of these kind of gray areas, shul dues, I've been involved with this too. I don't know whether that those kids went to college because they got a scholarship, whether their grandparents funded it. I really don't know. So you've got to be very careful about jumping to conclusions about how much worth, financial worth, that person has and how much they can afford by looking at some of these things. You don't know enough necessarily.
Right.
And you won't know unless you ask them directly. Again, you know, saying, well, you know, my kids went to college because they had a rich uncle in, you know, in some other country that sent them a check, you know.
Good, right. And I want to sort of take this opportunity, right, to focus us back in that we're having a conversation about the ways in which violating someone's privacy is Lashon Hara, but this is not necessarily an exhaustive conversation about Lashon Hara in its entirety, right? We're just sort of talking about how violating someone's privacy can be seen as Lashon Hara. So I reserve the right to not know any other Lashon Hara-related questions. Yeah, Stan.
I'm listening to this, and there's a lot of conflict in my mind, but I'm thinking, does anyone discuss it from thinking of it as the third person? In other words, how would that person feel if I said this? Let's say I happen to know that somebody owned a large house in Israel, which most people didn't know because we all lived in New Jersey.
Right.
My question would be, how would he feel if I said that he owned a large house in Israel?
Right.
Does that address the issue? Does anyone talk about that?
So that's the kind of conversation that the Chafetz Chaim would have, right? That's in the sort of details of what is considered to be Lashon Hara. But I think it doesn't overlap with our topic about privacy. Push on ahead. Okay. We're on page 3. We're looking at source 5. Rabbeinu Yonah. Eights of Repentance. This, I just love this text. And a person is required to conceal the secret that his friend has revealed to him. Right? What if I have knowledge, not because I saw it, but because I was entrusted with it? Even though there is no slander in revealing the secret, I'm not allowed to reveal what somebody else told me, even though there's no slander in the sense that it's totally true, right? And I got the information on the up and up.
And you're not allowed to invest either.
For in revealing the secret, there is damage to its owner and a reason for him to change his mind. As it says, he changes his mind in the absence of secrecy. Second, one who reveals a secret also exits the path of modesty, and he violates the will of the owner of the secret. And Solomon of blessed memory said, one who reveals a secret will be a talebearer. He means to say, if you see a person who cannot control himself enough to keep his tongue from revealing the secret, even though there is no actual slander between a man and his fellow in uncovering the secret, this character trait will bring him to become a talebearer. Right? If you can't stop talking the truth, eventually, to keep the fire going, you're going to start with the lies, which is one of the four classes of evil people, since he doesn't have his lips under his control in order to guard them. Right? So the second thing that Rabbeinu Yonah says here, which I feel like we all starting to get into, right? Not in terms of the person who is private, but what's going on with the person who's always trying to uncover the secrets, the person who's always trying to violate the privacy. He says it's true, right? There's nothing wrong with it. But there's a slippery slope here with this person, that he is on his way to start talking evil, to start making things up. And that there's actually a continuum, right, that goes from accidentally knowing innocuous things to making up slanderous things so that you have more things to talk about. And there being a kind of valorization here of keeping secret things secret and not talking all the time. What, you're running out of stuff to say? Stop talking. You don't know enough about this person? Great. Why don't you go listen to a piece of music? You don't have to always be talking. And sort of the first half of what he says, which we were talking about earlier when we were trying to come up with some of the values of privacy, I think is extremely beautiful and extremely meaningful. For in revealing the secret, there is damage to its owner and a reason for him to change his mind. Wait, there's some way in which when other people know something about me, it changes me, or it can change me. One way that I think is sort of helpful to think about this is in terms of reinforcement mechanisms, right? If I really want to, let's say I want to train for a marathon. So I have my Fitbit and I post on Facebook every day that I run. Right? And one of the reasons why I'm doing this, I mean, I'm doing it to brag, but one of the other reasons why I'm doing it, right, is the fact that other people know that I'm training for this marathon makes me want to get up the next day. Something about the fact that they know is incentivizing. Right? And the Rabbeinu Yonah is saying it's also true the opposite. Right? Something about the fact that people know something can be de-incentivizing. It can make me want to do it a little less. It can make me feel differently about it. And you can't do that to someone. Right? Each person has their right to determine not only what they reveal about themselves, but who they are. And there's something about Reuven and Shimon knowing about Levi that constrains Levi in a certain way. One of the examples that I always turn to when I'm thinking about this is I went to summer camp for 9 years, 10 years, for a long time, a sleepaway camp. And there are so many people who are different people at sleepaway camp than they are during the year. Right? The popular kid in school goes to camp and is a nobody. And the person who's like a nerd and doesn't have, you know, as many friends in school, he goes to camp and he's like the big man on campus and everybody loves him. What happens when somebody who goes to the same school as Nerd Boy shows up at cool camp and tells all of Nerd Boy's friends, you think that Nerd Boy is cool? Don't you know, right, that back home he is the least popular kid in school? This is public knowledge, right? There's a ranking. Everybody knows who's the least popular kid in school. But by presenting that information, you have prevented Nerd Boy from having the freedom to reinvent himself, right, from being the kind of person that he wants. And there's some way in which when other people know something about us, it makes us feel determined to be the way that we already are. And it doesn't allow us to develop or to change. And that's another reason, right, why we would want to be private ourselves and respect other people's privacy. Because we don't want to impinge on people's abilities to change themselves and to grow. Any thoughts or questions or comments about this? Okay. We're doing great. We have 15 minutes, which is not enough time to do this very long passage in the Orchot Tzadikim. It's the second time this week I've tried to teach this long passage in the Orchot Tzadikim and not succeeded in having enough time. But I'll tell you the reason why I brought this source. This is a source that's about shame, right? And what the Orchot Tzadikim is articulating here is that there's actually a value to having shame, to experiencing shame. And so some of the anti-privacy voices, right, say, get a GoPro, right? Record everything that's going on in your environment, because everything should be open, and everything should be shared, and everything should be perfectly transparent. And what the Orchot Tzadikim argues is that there's actually a real value to feeling that little bit of shame, to wanting things to be a little bit covered up, to wanting things to be to have the integrity of privacy. And his first proof, right, is that there's a connection between knowledge and awareness and maturity and adulthood and the ability to experience shame. Right, this is true of the primordial people of Adam and Chava, and this is true for each child as they're developing. Right, when you reach the stage of shame, that's an accomplishment and a sign of having a certain sense of self, having a certain sense of awareness, right? Both of yourself as like having an identity, and of yourself as having an identity that's separate from other people. Right? There's things about me that I reveal to myself that are not revealed to other people. Right? And that's a stage of maturity. And if we tell people you can't have shame, everything that you think is everybody else's business, everything that you do is available for other people to see, right? You're actually bringing people back. You're this is not a word, but you're immaturizing them, right? You're dematurizing them, or you're Benjamin Buttoning them, right? You're having them go sort of backwards in time. Does Benjamin Button go backwards or he goes forwards? I didn't see the movie. I should not, or read the book. I should not refer to things in the culture that I have not seen. Well, just something's a very important lesson right now. But anyway, all right, there's this risk that you are actually losing some of your inhibition, which is part of what it means to be mature, in deciding, I don't want to be ashamed, I don't want to be private, whatever I do is available for everybody else to see. And he says, specifically, right, that people should be trying to develop shame vis-a-vis God. So if you look on page 4, let's say we're about 4 lines down from the middle bolded verse. The last word on the line is and. And he will achieve these levels of shame when he isolates himself in order to think about the greatness of Hashem. Blessed be he. And it is constantly remembering that the Holy One, blessed be he, is the one who sees his actions and probes his innards and sees all of his thoughts. Right? And there's this desire to take the shame that you experience from being a human being, right? The shame that you experience in terms of how you interact with other people, and to use that to cultivate a sense of shame before God, right? To feel like there's always someone who is watching me, and that should affect the way that I act. And I actually want to cultivate a sense of shame from other people, because that enables me to cultivate this sense of shame that's going to allow me to develop my character, right, in a way in which I never want to be on the wrong side. I always want my behavior to be totally transparent, totally yep, you know. And the most beautiful expression of this idea that I have found is in the Maor Einayim, which is source number 7. Who would like to read?
Indeed, the truth is as it has been written by us in a different place in the name of Baal Shem Tov, on the verse, watching through the windows, peeking through the lattice. For the Creator, blessed be He, is watching through the windows, peeking through the lattice, meaning that He contracts His fear over a person who is going to commit a transgression in secret. For every hour it appears to Him, and He is afraid lest another person see Him. And He imagines in His mind, and He is afraid as if someone, one, is looking at Him from behind the window and peeking through the lattice. And through this fear falls upon Him.
And through this fear falls upon him
as if someone can see Him. I guess that was supposed to be someone, one.
Yes, but then someone over-formatted my source sheet. Okay. We're over it.
Okay. And He doesn't know that it is the scriptural, I'm sorry, the supernal fear. And does not know that it is that the supernal fear contracts himself for this person in order that he repent and separate from the transgression. Out of the great mercy of He who should be blessed, he contracts his fear, as it were, onto a person, on this low level. And for this, Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai said to his students, "May it be God's will that the fear of heaven shall be upon you like the fear of other people."
Beautiful. Right, so what the Baal Shem Tov is saying, first of all, the fact that he uses a verse from Shir HaShirim, right, which is, you know, has the most intimate language of the entire Bible, and has this verse which, you know, if you love someone and they're peeping through the cracks at you, that's very dear. If you don't love someone and they're peering through the cracks at you, that is creepy, arrestable, where's my restraining order? Right? So just using, even using a verse from Shir HaShirim already sort of gets you to think about sort of the importance of who is watching you, right, and does it matter? And the Dor Chor HaTzadikim wanted you to use the fear that you, use the shame that you have for other people, and have that be kind of like a training ground that will instruct you in how to have fear before God, how to have shame before God. But the Baal Shem Tov says, no. It's not that you're using one in order to train yourself for the other, but actually they are the same. And what God does is God is helping you out. God contracts his fear with a capital F, and you experience it as fear with a lowercase f, right? Actually, when you do something wrong and you think to yourself, I hope that nobody sees me, that's God doing you a favor, right? That is God allowing you to use your lowercase fear to do the right thing, right? To experience uppercase fear, right? And so instead of saying to yourself, I don't care what other people think about me, you should realize that the part of you that cares about what other people think about you is the part of you that cares about doing what's right. Right? And instead of trying to tamp that down and say, I'm going to do what I want no matter what, you actually kind of want to crank it up. Right? You want to crank up that experience of shame and fear so that you can use it to keep you from doing the wrong thing. Right? And you might think to yourself, this is so low. Right? I shouldn't care about what other people think. I should only care about what I think, or I should only care about what God thinks. And the Baal Shem Tov says, no, this human fear that we have of what other people are going to say about us and how other people are going to judge us, that's God doing us a favor. Right? That's God allowing us to use our humanity to save ourselves. Sort of a bad fences, right, make good neighbors. Right, in a certain sense, that the fact that you know that somebody could see you actually encourages you to be a better person. The fact that there's some sort of permeable membrane makes you aware of how you are in the world. Right? Yeah.
That would go against Hezekiah. Yeah. I would say it's a good thing that we know that people can watch us because then we won't behave badly. It seems to go against what we've been talking about, which is the value of privacy.
Right. Well, I think that's sort of the beautiful thing about privacy. Right, is that I get to decide what I want other people to see, and other people don't get to decide what they want to see. Right, so the Baal Shem Tov is not saying, you know, you should be extremely judgmental, and you should let everybody know that you're watching. Because if other people know that you're going to tweet about their bad behavior, they're going to be better. Right, the Baal Shem Tov is not saying that. The Baal Shem Tov is saying, you who are afraid that someone is going to tweet about your bad behavior, you should know right, that instinct, that fear and that shame and that wanting to cover up, is God communicating to you that you're about to do something wrong and you should listen to that instead of saying, I don't care what other people think, tweet away.
And then there's also the flip side, which I keep thinking about this article about this fellow who passed away, who saved all these kids in the Holocaust and never wanted it known. Mm-hmm. And so that's his right to privacy. Was that a good, and we obviously don't necessarily know the specifics of his case, but was that a good thing? Is that tsniut, that he was so modest about it, or that he didn't want that shared, or what? Is that, should, if we had done such a nice mm-hmm. thing, should we not want it shared? Is that the value that's being expressed here, you think?
I think that value is being expressed, and I think even more than that is the value of, if that person didn't want other people to know, we don't even have to ask why. We don't even have to evaluate whether or not we think that was a good choice on his part. We can just say, okay, thank you for saving those children. We're going to keep mum about this. And how hard it must have been for the people in his life who knew that he was a great man that wasn't getting the respect that he deserved, and how much they might have wanted to, you know, to tell a newspaper and get his name out. Like, I think we have to be, you know, sort of really in awe of the people that were able, who knew and were able to keep that secret, because they wanted this person to have their own wishes and to have a right to their privacy.
And one of the interesting things that you brought up about this shame, which is apropos to this technological society, is that we don't always know what's private and public anymore.
That's right.
So, you know, you're sitting in front of your computer and you're sending off emails or looking at different things that you might not, you shouldn't be looking at, or you are looking at. Who knows, okay, what, you know, what other people know that you're doing. So I guess what you're saying is that's the type of situation where shame can play a positive role in your life, where you don't know what is private and what's public. You say it's easy. You know, what's private is what I, you know, if I let other people know, but you don't always know what other people know about you, and that's what's scary about modern society.
Yeah, your desire to connect things back to the technological is very helpful. I want to say one thing about a technological, you know, experience that you can use as sort of a practice. When you want to Google something, and you open up a private tab, right, so that you can Google this thing incognito, right, so that your, I don't know if people do that, it's gonna save, your computer won't have a record of the fact that you made that search, and neither will your browser. You might ask yourself, why am I trying to hide this search, right? Why am I opening up a private tab to make this search or to, you know, to go to this website? When you're about to open up the private tab, ask yourself, why do I want that to be private? Right? If the reason why you want that to be private is like, it's about my health. I don't want my children to be worried if they see that I, you know, I Google leukemia, they might think that I have leukemia, so I don't want them to see it. Great, go into the private window. But if you don't want your kids to see that you're really interested in what's going on in Kim Kardashian, and that's why, right, you opened up the private tab, maybe you should say to yourself, I'm actually not going to open up the tab at all, and use that instinct to hide as a diagnostic tool, to ask yourself, like, why am I going there? And maybe I shouldn't be doing it. Yeah. We have time for one last comment or question.
For Hotep Tzadikim, the experience of shame psychologically is the experience of being exposed to other people. It's not a private matter. And that's why people don't want to be exposed. And it's a very astute observation that he makes. That if you think about it, you're never alone. You know, God knows is a very astute way of trying to get people to be aware that nothing in that sense is truly present in behavior somehow.
Right, exactly. And your fear shouldn't be that you're going to be exposed. Your fear should be that you're about to do something wrong.
Yeah.
Right, and that's sort of the way that you want to shift your
fear. But that's how you know. That's how you know.